name's Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here tonight. We were just laughing outside the meeting because when Billy called and asked if I could come up here one Sunday, it was maybe a month or a month and a half ago, and I was in my car in Ocean City and said, "Oh, that's great. I'm having trouble hearing you because we drove here into the hurricane to see the storm coming." And Billy promptly said, "Oh, I already relate to you. That's exactly the kind of thing I would do when I was drinking." And I got kind of quiet, and I hung up the phone, and I said to my boyfriend next to me, "Oh, my God, he's probably wishing he hadn't called me because I'm not drinking still, and here I am driving to Ocean City to see this hurricane happening." But that little bit of excitement, you know, still is still with me. So anyway, and I get constant reminders, too, of who and what I really am. Even today, I feel like any little trip for us, any simple outing can become an adventure for people like us. And just driving down here, we went to eat at this restaurant you recommended. I really feel like I should be sleeping rather than standing up to speak after this load of hush puppies we just swallowed down here. But we were sitting in the restaurant, and Rachel said, "Did you hear this song?" And the song was talking about, "I was your best friend, I got you in trouble in high school," and it was this country song, "and I got you in more trouble in college, but I was always with you," and alcohol was the refrain of the song, and this whole song was about how this guy's best friend was his alcohol, and how it was with him through his whole life, and, you know, it went through the story of him growing up with alcohol, and it sounded like it was talking about a person, but Sophie just said, "Oh, maybe one of us wrote that song," you know? And even here, we were driving, we were early, so we just kept driving by the church just to look around a little bit because it's such a beautiful day out there, and this is such a pretty area. So we kept driving to the stop sign at the end of the road and took a right and drove a little bit and pulled into this little gravel turnaround. And at the front of the gravel turnaround is a big, beautiful tree, you know, with all these split into a couple different sections. And sitting right at the base of it is a carton, a six-pack of beer bottles, empty, but all neatly put back in there, just left at the base of the tree. And again, we all laughed. I said, "I would have absolutely been drinking there last night under this tree when I was still drinking. That was just the kind of place." I got sober young, and so a lot of my drinking was under trees, in cemeteries, out in the woods, in people's basements, that kind of sneaking into bars when I could. So I get these little reminders on a constant basis of who and what I really am. I'm sure any of my sisters who are perfectly normal, or my mom or my dad, would have driven up to that tree and said something like, "Oh, look at that. I can't believe people left those beer bottles out there. Why was someone out there drinking under this tree on the side of the road?" And I instantly think, "I would have done that." So I get reminders I'm not like the average person out there, and I'm very glad to be here. So thank you for asking and for having us here. And I never would have guessed that being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous was something I would be excited to come do. I really was thinking on our drive down here. It was kind of a quiet drive. We were all quiet on the way here, just talking a little bit. But I was just really thinking, I never would have anticipated that a Sunday afternoon would be spent doing something like this, and never would have wanted to have anything like this in my life. I had no idea. I had no idea what was ahead when I got to AA, and certainly had no idea how to show up and be in other people's lives and be able to look people in the eye and talk to them and be a part of something so much bigger than I am. My world was so small and lonely and just a miserable, I felt like a miserable excuse for a human being by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So this is a joy to be able to come and be a part of something, and I love AA and I love what it does for all of us. And I feel like some of the greatest people I've ever met are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, oftentimes I hear people talk about not wanting to be here or I'm going to leave AA, and I just think, gosh, how much I would have missed out on, separate, aside from the effects of alcoholism, if I were still drinking and where I would be. But even setting all that aside, so many people and experiences that I would have been shortchanged on if I weren't here in AA with all of you. So I am grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be sober today. And my sobriety date is December 27th, 1992. And as James said, I'm part of the Midtown group, and that has been my home group since I got sober. And I did not get sober the first time I came to AA. I spent a couple of years in and out drinking, but I started drinking really young. I was part of a big Italian family. We spent a lot of time driving. Every month we would drive back to Detroit, where my parents were from, and my mom's parents had come from Italy with their oldest kids and had seven more kids once they got here, and they brought their pieces of their grapevines, and they grew grapevines in their backyard outside of Detroit, Michigan, and the whole backyard was covered with this roof of grapevines, and their basement was where they made the wine. And I fell in love with the basement in my grandparents' house really early, and I just feel like everything was so much brighter there. You know, I remember, I have such vivid memories of being really little and sitting on that back porch, just staring up, you know, watching all summer. We'd wait into the fall, when were the grapes going to be ready, you know, and the light filtering through the leaves. I was just obsessed with all of this from early on. And in the basement, these great barrels, you know, were taller than I was at the time, that they crushed everything in and made all the wine in. And there was this one trap door there into the wine cellar, and it was my favorite place to stay. And nobody wanted to be down there in that house, in that bedroom. It was a bedroom down in the basement, and it was all plaster walls except for one wall of paneling. And in that paneling was a trap door into the wine cellar. And you would go in there, and just all the shelves of all the bottles of vinegar and things fermenting and some wine that was already done, and just shelves of this stuff in your basement. And that basement bedroom was musty and cold and damp, and nobody else wanted to sleep in it. And it was my favorite room in the house, and they were happy to let me have it, so I took up less space upstairs, and nobody knew why I liked being down there. I didn't know at first either. I just knew I was really attracted to it down there, and found out just a few years later why it was a good place for me to be. And I spent a lot of time in that house, sneaking wine off people's, you know, off the table when dinner was over. Even the little kids, they just gave us a little glass of wine. And I'm the youngest of five kids. Nobody else is alcoholic. My parents are not alcoholic. So I think it never even occurred to them. People have asked me, do you blame your parents for giving you wine when you were little or doing all that? It hasn't even occurred to me, thankfully, to blame them. I think they just it never crossed their mind it would be a problem. You know, they were given little glasses of wine and champagne growing up when they were little with the family. They probably had the idea of, maybe if we do this with our kids, they won't feel the need to go out and get in trouble and think it's this big mysterious drinking thing to go discover. So I don't know. I just have never, thankfully, even gone down that road. All I know is I got the wine and I liked it. So that was enough for me. And really little, you know, my mom and I, a couple years ago, were going through some boxes in her house. I was trying to help her clean up, and we found some pictures from a house we lived in when I was about 3 or 4, and they're pictures at Christmas time. And it's a big blown-up 8x10 of a photo, and it's me when I was 3 or 4 years old wearing my cute little plaid wool Christmas kilt and my little red patent leather shoes and sweater, all dressed up for Christmas, and I'm holding a bottle or a little glass of brandy in my hands. And I have this grin on my face. And my mom looked at this picture a couple of years ago and said, oh, my God, if I had noticed that look on your face, maybe I would have had a clue, because there's something wrong. There's something wrong, you know. So from very early, and, you know, if I was sick or teeth were coming in or something, I was coughing at night, my dad would put a little tiny glass of brandy on the nightstand by my bed. And he would say, if you start coughing and you can't sleep, just take a little tiny sip. And you'll stop coughing and go to sleep. And he would leave the room and shut the door. And I would look at that glass of brandy and think, what if it doesn't work? What if it's gone? What if I start coughing and I drink it and I can't sleep and I'm still coughing and there's none left? And I would panic. So I would gulp this glass of brandy down and sneak downstairs and refill it and go back up to my room. And that was just, nobody told me to do that, or I had never heard that would be anything to make me feel better, but it was just the natural instinct that I had of, that tastes good, that feels good, I'm going to get what I want. And that bad attitude of, I'm going to get what I want at all costs, was a theme that became so big during my drinking, so big and so harmful to people like my family. So, you know, I had no idea. I just knew that I liked what I was, these little things I was sneaking and sipping here and there. And, of course, you know, I started getting older, and it just came to be something that was no longer being given to me at family gatherings. It was now something I was stealing out of the family liquor cabinet and sneaking out of the house with and smuggling bottles out, you know, all those things when you're that age. There's nobody socially drinking at 10, 11, 12 years old. And I was smuggling alcohol out of the house like crazy. My dad traveled a lot for work, and we had a cabinet full of those, you know, little miniature bottles of liquor that he would bring back. And they were the perfect size, I found out, to fit in a pocket in my backpack to bring to work and throw in my locker for the day at school. And you know, junior high age, I was drinking that in the mornings, or I could not make it for the day of school. I just couldn't. I would have, something would go wrong. I would have a panic attack. I would think I was sick. I would be nervous about a test, or I don't know, you know, if I wasn't drinking something at an early age, I could not make it through a day like that. I would just have such anxiety and fear of people and really irritable and just, I started becoming really unpleasant at an early age. And I started noticing other people weren't really doing some of the things I was doing, you know. And at first, of course, there are people in high school that are also drinking and sneaking out and doing these things. And I thought I was just doing what they were doing, you know. And these little instances started happening. I would be sitting in, I remember specifically, a chemistry class one day in high school. And the guy behind me was tapping his pen on the file cabinet behind my head. And it was like a Tuesday or Wednesday. But I'd been drinking the night before. And I'd gotten completely drunk by myself in my bedroom alone and had this explosive headache, and that pencil tapping, you know, that pen tapping on that metal was getting louder and louder in my head, and I started to get rageful, and I felt like my head was going to, I was just sick. I had a hangover, and I was sick. And I finally turned around, and I said, you have to cut that out. I mean, I feel like I turned into this monster. He just looked at me, you know, because I yelled at him, and you have to cut that out. My head hurts. I had too much to drink on her. Shut up, you know. And he just said, you did what? What do you mean you had too much to drink last night? And I kind of went on with my little story, and he said, well, who were you with? I said, I wasn't with anybody. And he said, you were sitting at home on a whatever Monday or Tuesday night by yourself, and you got so drunk that this is hurting your head today? And that was one of those first little lights going off of, don't tell. Just don't tell. If he's questioning me, don't tell them, because clearly this isn't something he was doing last night. And I knew that I didn't want to have anyone asking enough questions that would come to the point of someone telling me to stop doing what I was doing. And there were so many instances like that that started to become loud and clear. I was, you know, at a big party one night at somebody's house, and all the alcohol ran out in the house. The keg ran out. Everything was gone. Of course, it was someone's house whose parents were gone, and I started digging through kitchen cabinets to drink the lemon extract and the vanilla extract and anything I could get my hands on. And my best friend was there, who I'd grown up with since I was 3 years old, and I ran over to her thinking I had saved the day, saying, Erin, here, drink some lemon extract. And she just looked at me and said, what are you doing? I said, well, there's nothing left to drink, you know, there's nothing else in the house here, thinking I'm doing her this great favor, you know. And she just looked at me and she shook her head and said, there is something really, really wrong with you. And she turned around and walked away. And it was another one of those moments of, okay, check one more thing off that I can't reveal to other people, you know. But it was also one of the first times I remember hearing that question that became really constant of, what is wrong with you? There is something wrong with you. And it started coming from all sides. Yeah, I remember my parents would sit me down and say, can you just tell us what's wrong? We'll do whatever it is we can to help you in any way. We have no idea what is wrong with you. And I would just sit in silence. I would just stare at them like they were the devil doing something awful to me. I was such an angry, unhappy, disrespectful, rude monster of a kid that I had turned into, you know. And I would just sit there with my arms crossed and glare at them, and usually just nothing, you know, leave me alone, just leave me alone kind of an attitude. And that was the attitude I really developed throughout those years of high school. Just, I'm not bothering you, don't bother me, leave me alone, I'll leave you alone, don't cross paths, and we're fine. I just felt like everybody, stay out of my way. And that's a really lonely way to end up. It's a really lonely way. And even the friends I was drinking with all that time really started to get a little, you know, question, what's wrong with her? What's wrong with her? People started to drift away little by little. I was running around with all different kinds of people, and people that were stealing cars and people that were breaking into houses, and I'm going with them to do all this stuff. And, you know, it wasn't because we weren't even stealing anything. It was just that rush of, I know it's wrong, I'm drinking, I want to do something to try and not have to feel anything. I don't know what, that's another thing I should have said that started a lot earlier. There was nothing wrong with my family. My parents are still married, 51 years married now. Everybody else in my family, they're all married, happy, lots of kids, lots of grandkids in the family. they gave us everything we needed, and I had lots of attention, so I have no idea where I developed this insatiable need to feel better. I wasn't abused. Nothing bad happened to me. I can't even pretend to be a victim of anything. I was just really taken care of, and I was surrounded by people that loved me. And I have no idea where something happened. It's like the switch went off and nothing was enough. Nothing was good enough. Nothing felt okay anymore. I never felt okay around people. And I was always chasing for something just to not have to, now I know, face life on life's terms. I don't know why that was so hard for me at that age. But I couldn't do it. Like I said, just trying to show up for school, I couldn't do it if I wasn't drinking that morning or popping a pill or getting high in the bathroom before going into school or whatever it was. I couldn't show up for life. And, you know, people like my mom would sit there and say, can you just tell me what's wrong with you? And, you know, all I would be thinking is, I can't tell you that your voice sounds like fingernails on a chalkboard and I'm shaking and I'm sweaty and I need to get something to drink because I haven't had something to drink since yesterday and your voice is making me crazy. And it wasn't her. It wasn't her at all. But that's just the kind of state I was already living in at that age. And taking whatever people handed me, you know. People handed me, started smoking pot early on. I'm an alcoholic, absolutely. I used other things along the way and whatever it took to, whatever I could get was really the story. Whatever I could get. I hear people now, sometimes in our group, we have a lot of young people in our home group, and I just cringe sometimes when I hear people say, well, I never really drank. My thing was pot. I never really drank. I did this. And I sit in my seat trying to keep my mouth shut. Like, why are you here? This is AA. Why are you here? You know, so I'm definitely not, that's not my story. I was a drinker, and I love to drink. But I was just introduced to some other things along the way, you know, and a lot of hits of acid until someone gave me a little eyedropper full of liquid and said, if you just drop this into your eyes, it gets into your blood a lot quicker than sucking on that piece of paper will. And so anything people handed me like that, I was taking, you know. I didn't ask. I didn't question it. I didn't worry about it. And I was about 13 when I started to find things out very easily. If I do what some people want, they'll give me what they want, you know. And at 13 years old, today I watch my 13-year-old nieces and nephews, and I just... I'm horrified thinking that's the age I was doing some of the things I was doing. And to already be that dead on the inside, to have no remorse or guilt, no conscience, you know, I would just go find these people, and they were usually a couple years older than me, and they would give me something to drink or give me some pills, and I had no conscience about what I was doing with them and what I was doing to myself, and I had no even awareness that I was doing something damaging to myself. It was just, I was like a blank wall of nothing already, so dead on the inside. So when I got to AA for the first time when I was 17, I felt like I already knew. I really already knew there was something really wrong. And not long before my first AA meeting at 17, I had had yet another one of those experiences where I had decided I am not going to drink. No matter what tonight, I'm not going to drink. I'm in too much trouble. I'm getting caught left and right. People are chasing me down. I've been running from police a lot. Parents are wondering what happened to their house while they were gone. They're having people watch me. All this, you know, I can't drink tonight. I can't afford to get in trouble again. I don't want anyone to do something that's going to take away what I want to do, you know. And I went to this party, and I was making sure to tell everybody, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink tonight. I had made... Everything in me had made this decision I wasn't going to drink that night. And I remember drinking a can of Coke, and I remember being so angry that I was drinking a can of Coke. I ended up crushing this thing, you know, just out of that rage pent up, crushing this can of Coke in my hand. And finally, somewhere along the way, someone said, oh, you know, do you want a little rum? And without even a thought, it was like I had never made that decision. I couldn't remember changing my mind. It wasn't like I had this debate in my head about, oh, maybe tomorrow night I won't drink. Maybe I'll go ahead and drink it. I just took it. I just took it. And within minutes, I was just drinking out of the bottle and once again ending up with alcohol poisoning and back in the hospital. And that's one of those nights I really hope I don't forget, because I can clearly remember things like the look on my mom's face. I tried to go home. My friend, my best friend Aaron, who had said, why are you drinking that lemon extract, was driving me home yet again. I'm leaning out the window of her little blue bug and throwing up down the side of her car, begging her to please change clothes with me because, as I said, Your mom doesn't care if you go out and drink. Mine does, and you know I'm going to get in trouble. Please trade clothes with me. Now, I had been throwing up. I'd been spilling alcohol all over myself. I'd been rolling around somewhere outside in the dirt and the leaves, and I looked like, I don't know what I looked like. I don't want to know what I looked like. But she just looked at me and said, "You're crazy." And she opened her door in front of my house and pushed me out of the car that night and left me there to get in the house. This was the same friend that had been carrying me on piggyback. We would sneak out at night and go meet people and go drink or whatever we could do that night. And she would end up carrying me home piggyback to get me across the creek and through the woods. And she would dump me under the deck in my parents' house, the back deck, and leave me there to get you. "This is as far as I can get you. I'm not getting you back in the house." She knew that my dad got up at about 5:30 to get ready for work, so she would get me home before the sun was up and leave me there. And these little moments started happening. You know, it was the middle of winter, and she was hosing me down under their back deck. Because like that night, I was in her car. I had thrown up all over myself. I had fallen into the creek, mud everywhere. I reeked of rum. I had spilled it all over myself like I always did. And she was hosing me down. She pulled the hose out from under their house, the porch, and was rinsing me off. And it was cold, and the water was cold, and I just remember standing there. It's funny to think of now. I was standing there with her hosing me down, thinking, this isn't happening to other people. Nobody else is, the neighbors are not under their deck at 5 in the morning getting hosed off by their friend who just dragged them home so they can hopefully sneak back in and not get caught again, you know? So anyway, this night she was driving me home that I ended up with alcohol poisoning. She wouldn't trade clothes. And I thought, what a jerk. You know, she could just help me get out of this one last time. And she rolled me out of the car instead and left me there. And I got in the house. And, you know, by now everybody is on to me absolutely. And they're screaming about, "Get back down here. Where have you been? Have you been drinking?" Surprise, surprise. And I just ran by them. I said, "I don't feel good. I have to go to bed." Thinking, that's the crazy thing. When I drink, I have this altered perception that other people don't see the condition I'm in, or they don't really know how drunk I am, or they don't see, you know, the throw up and the liquor spilled and the hair out to here with tree branches in it and everything else. And I would climb trees when I drank. I climbed a lot of trees to get away from people, so tree branches and leaves were common. And I ran to my room thinking, I got away with it, you know, laying in my bed with my covers pulled up to here just in case they walked in. And I could hear my mom screaming bloody murder down there, "Get back down here," you know. Of course they're terrified. So much has happened by this point. This is just one little episode I'm telling you about just because it's one of those times when I can remember somebody, how painful it was to see somebody else's face looking at me. And she finally came up and dragged me out of bed by my foot. You know, she had her hand around my ankle and yanked me out of that bed. And my mom is little. She's like 5'1", and she's not violent at all. And here she is dragging me out of bed because of the condition I bring into the house, forcing me to come stand in the kitchen and tell her and my father what I'd been doing that night. And all I could think of was, I'm about to throw up. My mom's asking, try to answer the question, you know, try to answer the question. And I knew I was not going to be able to answer her question. And that the fluorescent lights in that kitchen have never seemed so bright in my whole life, I think, as that night. And the rest of that night was just one of those in and out of consciousness nights, remembering laying on the bathroom floor, hearing her trying to get on the phone with all the other parents and who was there and what happened to her and what did she take. And this couldn't just be from alcohol, because she couldn't imagine somebody would drink that much alcohol to have this happen to them. Anyway, so one more of those nights of alcohol poisoning and just their, you know, the faces of people that love us the next day, just that complete, discouraged, disappointed, what in God's earth can we do with you kind of faces was what I saw in my mom and dad. So that was the way I did a lot of damage with my family, that kind of behavior. And somewhere in there, you know, they'd been sending people to watch me when they went away because they knew now what I was up to. And this one particular weekend, they had sent my sister and her husband to come stay, thinking maybe this will prevent her from going wild in the house with people, or just from going wild myself even. And my solution was, of course, I had told everybody, "Come on over to drink tonight." You know, and the solution that I came up with was, well, my sister's here, her house is now empty, and we broke into my sister's house that night instead. I snuck out of the house, her and her husband were asleep. I snuck out and went into their little one-bedroom condo that they owned, brought the party along with us. You know, had a train of all these cars following us out to Centerville from where my parents' house was, and spent this wild night in this little one-bedroom condo. And again, it was winter. I don't know why winter seems like my good time or not so good time, but so we had cranked the heat up in their house. We started a fire in the fireplace of their condo. We had music on. People were popping popcorn and drinking, and it was just this crazy party going on in there. And I vaguely remember trying to clean up, thinking that I had done a really good job cleaning up, you know. And we have garbage bag loads of the cans and the bottles and everything, and we brought them out the front door of her condo, and I plopped them on the curb. And I remember Aaron saying, "Don't you think we should move these a little further? Because they might know." And I said, "They're going to have no idea anybody was here." And went home, crawled back in bed, and passed out until who knows what time the next day, to my sister calling me in absolute hysterics about how they'd gone home and how someone had broken into their house the night before and the police were there fingerprinting and they couldn't figure out what had happened because it didn't seem like people had really taken anything, but the house was just trash. There were beer bottles. And she said, "It's like someone just came in to have a party, except that now I'm afraid to sleep in my own house at night because someone's been breaking into my house." And she drove over and she just sat me down and said, "Just tell me if you had anything to do with this, because if I know it was you, at least I'm not going to be in terror every night that random people are just breaking into our house, and I'll know it's you and your mess of a life going on here." And I looked her straight in the eyes and said, "I have no idea what you're talking about. You were staying with me at Mom and Dad's house last night. I went to bed when you did. That's crazy." And I had the ability to look someone in the eyes and tell them something like that, knowing how afraid she was of her own house at that point. And all I cared about, once again, was, "I can't get caught. I just can't afford to get caught. I can't pay the consequences. I'll go to any length to not get caught for this kind of stuff." I had no respect left for anybody. No respect. Thank God and Alcoholics Anonymous people here really, really have taught me how to have some kind of respect for any little thing in life. You know, start from our meeting to our home group to my sponsor, the people I sponsor, there's just this level of respect that I was completely void of all those years. And you know, those are the kind of things that have been repaired, thankfully, in sobriety. That sister of mine now has three little boys, and the youngest one, a couple years ago, they actually asked me to be the godmother to this little boy, and they let me take them and watch all three of them at the same time, and they know I'm not going to break into their house now. And it's amazing how other people have the ability to forgive that has been really long in coming for me. And she is the sister that I constantly complained to my sponsor, "You know, my crazy sister, that one, the crazy one, the crazy one." And she's not alcoholic. She has her own problems. But my sponsor finally said, "You are not allowed to call her crazy anymore. You're not allowed to say, you know, that crazy sister of mine, because you will never have the change of heart that needs to come about for your eighth and ninth step with her if you keep referring to her as that crazy sister." So that was the beginning of that one. But just last year, I was having dinner at her house with her husband and her three boys, and something came up about how one of their neighbors' houses had been broken into. And her littlest boy said, "Mommy, I'm really afraid. What if someone breaks into our house? Is that going to happen to us? Has anyone ever broken into our house before?" And I'm sitting at the table thinking, yeah, I have. And my sister that I always called crazy didn't even flinch. She was just so forgiving and graceful, and her main concern is not scaring her kids. And she looked at him and said, "Christopher, no, we're perfectly safe in our house. Nobody's going to break in. It's fine." And she didn't look at me. She didn't glare at me. She didn't kick me under the table or pull me aside later to say, "Remember that time you did this to our house?" You know, none of that was necessary for her. And that's because the appropriate amends have been made there. Thanks to a good sponsor and going through the steps, amends have been made for those kind of harms that I did with my family. So I can't imagine where that would have turned out on my own power, what I would have continued doing in damaging relationships like that. So I could even, you know, I was 12 years sober when my nephew said that. Even that far into sobriety, I get these pangs of, oh, I still remember how I caused harm to people. Even after I think most of the amends are done or repairs have been made, I still get those little reminders. So, you know, some of them are funnier than others. I was maybe 5 years ago having lunch with a girlfriend of mine who's also sober. And we'd gone to an AA meeting down in Georgetown. And we're sitting in a nice restaurant, and we both come from work, so we're wearing our business clothes for work, and we look like relatively normal, cleaned-up, professional young women sitting in this restaurant eating, except that the restaurant is really small, and tables are really close together, so people can hear you. And there was a couple sitting next to us who looked like maybe on their first date or something, you know, because they were really awkward and not really talking and fumbling with their silverware and trying to make conversation. You know, we couldn't help hearing. They were asked, oh, what do you do, and where'd you go to school? And then my friend Grace Ann and I started talking, and she was asking me about my oldest niece, and I said, it's not looking good. She's crashing cars, drinking. She did this to her parents' car this time. She caused this kind of, had a party in their house when they weren't there, all this stuff. And my friend Grace Ann said, well, that sounds like what you used to do. You used to steal people's cars. And I distinctly heard silverware clatter to my left because these two people trying to have this little date or whatever heard this and looked at us and just shot, you know, they got really quiet. They were already quiet, but all conversation stopped. And you could just see the girl sitting next to me kind of like looking at us to see if we looked all right. And my first thought is say something quick to make this not sound as bad as that sounds. And, you know, I had no notice to think I'm not good with the quick thinking. And I blurt out, yeah, but at least we weren't stealing our family's cars. We were stealing cars of people we didn't know, Grace Ann, you know. I don't think it helped at all. So, once again, I'm not like other people, and I'm glad I get those kind of reminders because I don't want to forget where I came from. I really don't want to forget where I came from. And anyway, by the time I got here, I came to my first meeting when I was 17. I heard someone had gone to Catholic school all those years, from kindergarten to 12th grade. I was in a Catholic school, and we had to go on these retreats to graduate. And at the beginning of my senior year, we were on one of these retreats, and they had someone who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous as one of the team leaders on this retreat. And he didn't talk about Alcoholics Anonymous at all. He just told his story of drinking and how he ended up getting sober and what had happened to him. And I related so much that I didn't know what to do after hearing this guy. And I talked to him a little bit, and he said, well, why don't you just come to a meeting? Not that I'm suggesting you're alcoholic or that you need it, but if you're interested, you can always come with me to an open meeting. And he brought me to an AA meeting in my senior year of high school. And I walked in and instantly saw someone who I had gone to my Catholic grade school with, you know, all those years, sitting in the room. He said, my name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know why I couldn't take it. I just freaked, and I ran into the parking lot, and the guy who brought me followed me out there, and a couple of the girls followed me out there, and I was just screaming at this poor guy in the parking lot, why did you bring me here? I don't need to be here. You know, I think I started hitting him or something, and they took me home and dropped me off, and I wasn't ready for AA. I came to a few more meetings. They said, this is Kelly. Kelly's going to be your sponsor, and this poor girl Kelly would call and say, oh, Debbie, I'm going to come pick you up for the meeting tonight, and I would just scream, and I am not going to any meeting with you people, and slam the phone down on her, and I would show up every now and then in a meeting and be so offended when people said, are you drinking? Or have you been sober? You haven't been sober all this time. And I would think, how dare they accuse me? Of course I was drinking. I was absolutely drinking. And stumbled into some meetings drunk, stumbled into some meetings high. Nobody ever told me to leave as long as I wasn't disrupting everything. No one told me to leave. I don't know if I heard anything. I believed I was an alcoholic at that point. I just had no interest in being anything different and stopping still. I just had no interest, and I felt like I was willing to pay the prices that drinking brought along with it until this one really god-awful weekend somewhere, and I kept trying to get sober, and I would drink again and try to get sober and drink again, and I spent a weekend locked up in a bedroom with a couple bottles of rum and a handful of other drugs, and had this weekend of feeling like, this is it. I'm not going to make it this weekend. And I don't know if I took something bad. I don't know what happened that weekend, but I remember another one of those times I don't ever want to forget, because I remember laying in my bed that weekend just staring at the ceiling. And one minute my heart was pounding so fast, it felt like it was going to blow out of my chest. And the next second I couldn't breathe. I would be gasping for air, trying to. I had no will to go call for help or to ask anyone to come help me. I thought, if I don't wake up tomorrow morning, that's fine. That's just fine. I had no will to be a part of life anymore. It was just a problem. It felt like the biggest burden in the world to show up for life anymore, and I had no interest. I had driven all my friends away. It wasn't that they all bailed on me and left me there. It was that I would say things to people like, get out of my way. Get out of my way. I'm not going to stop what I'm doing. I don't want you to stop me. Just get out of my face. And I pretty much had had that attitude with my family as well. So that weekend, I really felt like, if this is it, this is it. You know, I could have cared less. I felt like it would have been a relief. Just the absolute terror of what physically happened to me that weekend was enough to try staying dry. I thought I was sober. I wasn't sober. I didn't go to meetings. I didn't have a sponsor. I knew nothing about what the steps were or what Alcoholics Anonymous was about. I just knew I wasn't drinking. You know, it was like that unbearable, constant, irritable tension of I'm not drinking, and this really is awful. This is really awful feeling, and I spent about a year living that way. And I became more unbearable and miserable dry than I think I had been at the end of that drinking bout. My college roommate moved out because I was so unbearable. I stopped going to classes. I had nobody left that was interested in talking to me at that point. I was an angry mess. I started to get violent, which I'd been angry but not outwardly violent all that time. And I was in school for painting, for art. And somewhere in there, in a rage, I had punched a cinder block wall in my dorm room and broke multiple bones in my right hand. Couldn't paint for months, and I didn't care. I couldn't do anything in any of these classes I was in, and I had no care whatsoever. I just became like a completely different monster of a person, not drinking. And of course, after only so long of that, you know, after about a year of that, I thought, this is so unbearable. Why bother? Why am I doing this? Of course I drank again after that. It was like the greatest relief to finally make the decision, I'm going to go have something to drink tonight. And it just instantly felt like I could breathe easier again, just knowing that that decision was made. And I went out that night and planned to drink maybe a beer or two. I have no idea why. I hated beer. I never liked to drink beer before that. And I don't know why I thought that would be the answer for that night, but I thought I'll have one or two cans of beer just to ease this misery, you know. And I remember the first couple cans of beer that night, and once again, blackout after a year of no alcohol in my body. Came to the next day, somehow in my dorm room, in my bed again, and I just opened my eyes and thought something's really wrong, and kind of limped up into the bathroom there and turned on the light and was staring in the mirror at this bloody mess of a person, my first night drinking, and the whole left side of my body was blood and cuts and gravel stuck in it and scraped, and all the clothes on the side of my body were torn up and shredded, and found out later that I had just gotten so sloppy drunk, and police were coming and people were trying to get me out of there before the police got there and ended up dragging me partway down a gravel driveway. And that was the condition I found myself in the next morning, and made a conscious decision. I'd just spent a year not drinking. I couldn't take it. I was so miserable. This kind of stuff might just happen every now and then, but I'm going to keep drinking. I made a conscious decision that morning looking at this mess in the mirror here, and I spent the next year and a half drinking again. And it became so lonely and unbearable. It was just you know, one of the sorriest times I can think about today. And thank God for that. Clearly that was what I needed. And at the time I had no idea. Now I can look back and really understand a first step and the rest of the steps, because what alcoholism for me is, just not drinking for that year was not a solution. Just that year I spent being dry was absolutely not a solution for my alcoholism, because life was so unbearable not drinking, I chose consciously to drink and have those kind of consequences happen. And I need some other kind of solution other than just the not drinking for my alcoholism. So thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and for this different solution we have here. And I have no idea why I finally called someone after I spent that next year drinking again. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary. It wasn't a particularly bad night. I just woke up one day and thought, I'm not going to be able to keep doing this. I'm just not. I'm so tired and worn out. And I was 19 years old, and I knew that 19-year-old, something in me knew, shouldn't be feeling this way. Like, once again back to a place where I have no interest in life anymore. And I had one phone number of a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why I had it. I don't remember where it was. I just knew I had it, and I called her. And she was smart. She didn't say, come to meet me at a meeting, or you've got to get to a meeting. She said, well, if you're not really too comfortable and you'd like to go out for coffee and tell me about your last year, why don't we do that? And I thought, oh, that I can do. I'm happy to go sit with her and drink coffee and talk. I don't know what we're going to talk about, but... And I did, and I told her about the last year, and by the end of it, she said, well, I've got to get going to get to the meeting. You're welcome to come with me if you want. And that was exactly the right way for her to get me that night. And I went with her to the meeting, and that was just a couple months, you know, still had that fight in me. And I showed up, and she was sponsoring me finally. I had a sponsor, and finally I was going to meetings regularly and trying to get started on these steps. And I don't know, I just had such a fight in me still, like, I'm not going to do what you people are doing. I'm just not really ready for this. I'm not going to do what you guys are doing. And I wouldn't talk to people. People would try to be so nice to me in meetings, and I would be like this. Unfortunately, I'm sitting here like this right now. I would often be like this in meetings, you know, and had no interest in talking to anybody there. I felt like, I don't want to tell you about myself. I don't want to know about you. I could care less. I was really so self-centered and so consumed with my own feelings and feeling bad. I didn't want you to tell me about you either, you know. People would think, well, at least if she's not going to talk, we'll talk and tell her our stories. And I would think, I don't care to hear your story. I'm not interested. And I don't know why I even stayed for this couple of months that I did, but it was Christmas night in 1992, and this woman, Jennifer, was driving me home from the meeting and said, are you going to drink tonight? I feel like you might drink. There's something, you don't seem right. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm fine. I'll talk to you tomorrow. And I walked in the house and went straight and got a bottle of rum and had that one last bottle of rum by myself in a basement again. And couldn't stop drinking until someone showed up to get me for a meeting 2 days later. I missed a whole day in there. I don't know what happened to December 26th. I thought I just had my one night out drinking again, but I lost a day in there somewhere. And someone told me one morning they were coming, the 27th, they were coming to get me to go to a meeting. And he said, can you not drink until I get there? And I said, of course. And I promptly sat in the living room window with a bottle of wine all day long, sipping on this bottle of wine until his headlights pulled up that night. I didn't even try to not drink until he got there. And you know, that got to the meeting, it's my home group now, and picked up a 24-hour chip that night, and, you know, still, I was just so argumentative and belligerent, and I picked up my 24-hour chip, and I went running out of the meeting. The meeting's about 300 people, and I was humiliated and partially still didn't want to surrender, and I don't know, I just know, I picked up my 24-hour chip and thought, what have I done? And I turned around and ran, you know, up the aisle, up the stairs, out onto P and 22nd Streets in D.C., downtown D.C., and a couple of people followed me out yet again. And nobody tried convincing me this time. You know, nobody tried talking me into staying here or why I should be sober or tried telling me why I needed to do this. And someone just put their hand on my arm and said, we are offering you a friendship. If you want it, we're here. And that was something I hadn't heard before. And I started to hear people later talking about the language of the heart, and I know that that's what they meant by that kind of thing, because nobody, I'd been to see psychiatrists by that point, they'd sent me to Springwood Mental Institute, and trying to figure out what was wrong with me there, you know, and nobody had ever said something like that by way of a solution or offering of anything, and that caught me that night. That just that simple little statement someone made caught me. And people that I was seeing in these meetings were alive in some kind of way that I knew I was not alive. They just had this light in their eyes. They were laughing and talking, and I couldn't carry on a conversation and talk, let alone laugh with anybody. And that was what was appealing to me. I was finally surrendered enough, I guess, that I could look around and see people. They were interacting with each other, and they had people that they cared about and that cared about them in these meetings, and they were just alive and bright and happy, and, you know, not that they didn't have problems. They shared. I heard them in meetings talk about what was going on or difficulties they were having, but they just had this life that I was really missing, and that was what finally, I think, kept me here and gave me some new willingness to really find out what the steps were. how I could really use a sponsor, how to work with a sponsor, and I did. I started right away. I had my sponsor, and she started me taking me through the steps right away, and we would go and read at her house. She had me start writing my. I kept saying the third step. I don't know what I'm supposed. You know, what am I supposed to do? I wanted to try and figure everything out. I thought it was all this intellectual thing to think through and figure out. And she said, if you really want to get past the third step, why don't you start writing your fourth step? Because at least you'll be willing to do something other than your great little scheme of what you want to do and only what you want to do. And that was the first kind of light bulb of that's what it means. You know, maybe that's any little willingness to try it somebody else's way other than mine. Because I had been living constantly with this very short-sighted, it was like tunnel vision, you know. I thought I knew what I needed to be okay. And anything outside of that, I was just completely blind to. And I wasn't willing to listen to anybody. So that little statement she made, I thought, I can do that. I can write a fourth step. I can do that. And I did. And kept going through the steps, thankfully, you know, and I've always had a sponsor. I've always worked really closely with a sponsor. That woman, unfortunately, started to get really resentful about, I don't know what, I don't want to know what to this day. And things started happening, like I would call her and she'd say, I can't talk to you now, I'll see you at the meeting tonight and we'll talk then. And I would get to the meeting and she just wouldn't be there. She stopped coming to meetings. And I didn't know what was going on with her to this day. I don't know what was going on with her, but all I know is I needed to get to a meeting and I needed to see somebody there that was also going to be at the meeting that I could talk to. So for whatever reason, I knew I needed a new sponsor and got a new sponsor right away. And thank God, I've always been working closely with a sponsor that's been taking me through the steps. And people threw me into service really early here, mopping floors at our home group meeting. I think I had 2 weeks sober, and they were having a group conscience and said, we need a new assistant cleanup person, you know, to help mop the floors and all that. And I'm hiding in the corner, and my sponsor said, I nominate Debbie to be the cleanup person. And she kind of leaned over and whispered, she has 2 weeks today, you know, and everyone raised their hand to vote that I got the service job. So that was my first service job. And I would be cussing that room out in my head every Sunday night, mopping those floors, thinking, yeah, everyone else is outside talking, and they're having fun, and they get to go home and go to bed, and I have to be up at 5:30, why am I mopping this floor, and there were 300 people in here, some pigsty in here, but by the end of that year, when that job rolled over, every Sunday, I would sit there glaring because they were mopping the floors the wrong way after that, you know? So I had started to have some kind of little ownership and commitment and have a care for something other than my own tiny little selfish world. And it has, that's been the path I've been shown here, is it's got to be about something other than me. And thank God my sponsor's voice is louder than my head. And whenever I'm complaining to her or griping about something, I hear her voice, you know, it's not about you, it's not about you. And usually that doesn't make sense to me at the time, you know, and then later I get a great glimpse of how perhaps this instance that happened and I felt uncomfortable about was not at all about me feeling uncomfortable. Really, it was meant to help somebody new that was watching this all go on, you know, who came to me later and said, I was so glad I got to see you go through that because I wouldn't know what to do with, you know. So just all these little instances where I followed somebody else's direction, done things anyway that I didn't know why I was doing, and later find out it really wasn't about me. It was really about perhaps being useful to somebody else, and not the answer I would have come up with on my own for a solution to my alcoholism. It's definitely not the answer I would have come up with, so thankfully it's been handed to me like that, and I got involved right away. People said, oh, come with us to this general service assembly, and come to intergroup with us, and come to this intergroup conference and workshop, and thank God for those things because it introduced me to a lot of people in AA who were a lot further along the path than I was and who had a lot of experience to pass on and give me chances. You know, they would start handing stuff over for me to do the next time, and I would feel like I had my important little job to carry out, and, you know, now I can pass it on to people I sponsor and watch them do it with the people they sponsor. And you know, like I said in the beginning, these were never things that I would have thought I cared about or wanted or would have helped my life in any way, and I just wouldn't trade any of it. And, you know, I had broken my hand, like I said, while I was in school painting, and at 2.5 years of sobriety was able to go live in Italy to paint and study for a while. And that was one of those things, one of those dreams that had died with everything else, you know, and that whole will to live evaporating. That was just one of them, you know, one of the many things I had always dreamed of doing. And in sobriety, I had a sponsor that said,
Well, of course you should apply for that.
Of course you should. And I remember the day I got the letter saying I was accepted, and I called my sponsor and said, I got in. What do I do? And my sponsor said, what do you mean? What do you go? That's what you do. You know, you go. And I would still shortchange myself and constant things like that. And I've had a chance to go through the steps many times at many different points in sobriety and work on the amends again, so that when my whole family came together for my parents' 50th wedding anniversary last summer, they wanted us all to go. They said, we don't want anything from you kids. We just want a week away together with the whole family. Now, of course, for us, that was like the biggest, scariest thing they could have asked us for, as opposed to anything. But we all said, okay, we'll go. And I did not have to be the source of any family drama that week, really. I did not have to be a cause of anyone else's problems. I wasn't sneaking liquor to hear someone say later, where is the Tanqueray for the martini? You know, cussing everyone out, wondering who stole what this time. And I think my niece was doing some of that, but it wasn't me this time. And it was really, last year, that last summer, two summers ago, was probably one of the most meaningful, richest times I've had in my sobriety, just spending that time with my family that way and being on the boat with my dad during that week. You know, we'd be coming in at sunset and other people would be up in the front of the boat, and he would just be talking away about times growing up or his time spent in Vietnam that he had never really wanted to talk about before. And I just remember one night in particular, coming in that night on the boat, just looking at my dad thinking, we never would talk to each other. I never had anything to say to him. He was the last person in the world I wanted anything to do with telling about myself or hearing about him. And those kind of gifts, you know, they don't worry about me today. And he sat me down one day and last year and he said, you know, I know your mom worries all the time. She doesn't want you going on these crazy trips you go on. She thinks something's going to happen to you. And hurricane insincere, right? But he said, I know that you're okay today and I don't worry about you anymore when I go to bed at night. And I've met your friends, and they're the greatest group of people we could hope for you to end up in the middle of. And he said, you've gotten to experience more of life than a lot of people a lot further along in life than you are. And he said, I know you're okay today. And those kind of things, little by little, start to chip away at all that guilt of the damage done, for a lot of years of making amends for these things and just showing up and showing up for a meeting like this. If I'm asked to show up to mop the floor, whatever it is, has taught me how to show up for the family. Be there when I say I'm going to be there. You know, show up for school enough years to go through and finish school and have a job today that I really, absolutely love and I'm so grateful for. And get to do things that I never experienced. And people that a couple of years ago wanted to go to Montana. There was an AA conference. Most things today for me revolve around AA. And there was this AA conference in Montana, and I said, Rachel, I've always wanted to go to Montana. Do you want to come with me? And she said, sure. And we set off and drove 1,200 miles around Montana after going to this AA conference and got to meet a lot of people from a lot of different AA groups around the country who were so active and alive and, you know, serious about sponsorship and the steps. And her and I went climbing over the Continental Divide in Glacier National Park in Montana, and we climbed and climbed, you know, hiked all this way up and stared down into this glacier. And on our way down, we were just screaming, we're like, ooh, you know, because, and we kept asking each other, how do people like us end up doing something like this? How do people like us end up here? Because we don't get to do these. You know, I couldn't be anywhere. I couldn't make it anywhere before I got sober. And so I'm so grateful for that. And I feel like anything I can do for AA, just to start giving back little chunks of what I've been given here, is exactly what I've been taught to do and what I hope I keep doing. Because I want to, there's that line in the book, and before the text of the big book actually starts, it talks about the purpose of this all is for us to end up feeling happily and usefully whole, or something to that effect. And that feeling of being happily and usefully whole, I thought maybe I'll get it when I have everything I want one day, or when things go my way, or when I'm perfectly happy with all the circumstances in my life. And I've never been someone that gets my way in sobriety. I feel like maybe I would be drunk if I did. So I'm okay with that right now, that things don't seem to go my way all the time. But from showing up and trying to be about somebody else and something bigger than my own little life has really brought about that feeling of being happily and usefully whole. So thank you very much for asking us to be here tonight, and I'm glad to be here with you all. Thank you.